91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a visit by the longtime editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. His many duties there now include hosting the New Yorker Radio Hour on public radio stations, including South Florida's WLRN. The magazine was founded in 1925 and is known for its erudition, cartoons, fiction, satire, and clever cover designs. How do those translate to an audio medium? We'll learn more in a bit. And Linda Gassenheimer, today she welcomes famed chef Eric Ripert, author of 32 Yolks, From My Mother's Table to Working the Line, a memoir of his journey from Andorra to Manhattan. That's next after the news.
Seven minutes after 1 o'clock. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper.
Thank you.
Well, readers of the New Yorker magazine, two of them are sitting right here, anticipate each weekly edition for its reporting, commentary, criticism, essays, fiction, satire, cartoons, of course, and poetry, and the beautiful titled hand-drawn cover.
The New Yorker is a legacy magazine, of course, dating from 1925. It's expanded into the website, app, and social media spectrum, and in October first offered the New Yorker Radio Hour. The program airs at 2 p.m. each Saturday here on WLRN.
And with us now is the veteran editor of the New Yorker, David Remnick. He's also
hi,
the host.
Are you?
Hi.
Veteran. I sound so old.
Venerable.
Venerable, grizzled, all that stuff.
Well, you are the host of the New Yorker Radio Hour, in addition to all your other many responsibilities. So how's the new project going?
It's fun. I have to say, it's fun. And, you know, I've been a radio nut all my life, and to take part in it rather than to be the occasional once in a blue moon guest is fantastic. I think you know very well that radio is going through a real renaissance of creativity and reach, and both on the air and in podcasting, and it's fun to be a part of it.
I couldn't imagine the New Yorker Television Hour.
You can now. In fact, Amazon has a New Yorker program that starts in February.
Really?
Yeah, you backed that car right into the garage.
It's not just video of you, of the radio producers.
No, God forbid. No. It's a separate show in a kind of magazine, 60 Minutes type format, based on New Yorker pieces and humor as well. And it's done by Alex Gibney, a documentary filmmaker that's probably one of the best in the country. And The projects are different. The television thing is very much in Alex Gibney's hands, and we kind of give advice and provide stories in a certain way, but it's a little less in our control. The radio thing is right up the, in the floor above me. We have a studio right in the New Yorker offices. People from the local public radio show are here to produce it, and they're great. And that's the way we do that. So our involvement in that is up to our chins.
Do you decide content on the shows, the New Yorker Radio Hour, as well as hosting?
Well, it's collaborative. Okay. In other words, there's a guy named David Krasnow from WNYC, which is the New York version of your station. And he and his team are working with me and other people at the magazine to conceive of the show, what it should be, who we should talk to, what the reported pieces should be. So it's very much a collaborative effort.
Now, the program, again, airs Saturday at 2 p.m. here on WLRN. For those listeners who haven't heard it, David, what can they expect from it?
Well, you know, on a given show, I'll usually do an interview with someone. I interviewed Amy Schumer, Gloria Steinem, founder of Black Lives Matter, Ta-Nehisi Coates, a range of people in various worlds, just like you would do it, you would see in the magazine, a kind of New Yorker profile. But there's also humor pieces. There are the equivalent of a reporter at large piece, on politics, on sometimes it's lighter, sometimes it's more serious. It's inspired by the magazine, but it's got to be its own thing. Nobody's reading cartoons over the air. You know, that we're not. That would be incredibly lazy and not very interesting.
No. Well, now that you've interviewed so many people for the eye, how different is it interviewing people for the ear?
It's such a good question. It's so different because when I'm interviewing somebody for a written piece, I'm a kind of discursive and all over the place, and I know that I have, if I'm lucky, pretty much unlimited time with that person.
Right.
And it's only later that I go back and listen to the tape or look at my notes and see what it is I'm using. And a lot of what I'm using is descriptive rather than straight quotation. Here, it's got to be a much more disciplined conversation. It's happening in real time. Even if you're taping it and editing it, it's happening in real time with two people talking in a room. So it's an entirely different craft, and I have a lot of respect for people who do it well, and I'm learning from them all the time.
But you do edit the interviews somewhat after you conduct them.
Sure. You know, you don't want to inflict the boring bits in this format anyway.
You don't have that luxury.
Yeah. No, I'll try. So I'm going to try not to be ruthlessly boring.
Well,
I'll self-edit.
What about, because I'm thinking, you know, we're reading a tragic piece or we're reading a really serious piece or a profile in The New Yorker, mm-hmm. and there's a Roz Chast cartoon thrown in or a Ziegler cartoon thrown in.
Sure.
So we can at least get some relief from whatever we may need from reading that piece. So how do you translate that?
Well, without, like life, you know. If we had nothing but laughs, we'd fall over with a stomach ache and we'd be pretty banal. If we had nothing but tragedy, we'd all fall over for a different reason. And the great gift of The New Yorker that I didn't invent but rather inherited from the originators of The New Yorker is its capacity to shift gears tonally from one page to the next. And even on the same page, you know, if you're reading a long New Yorker piece about, say, the Middle East, there's also gag cartoons mm-hmm. speckled throughout the and that's a formula of the New Yorker. It's kind of an unlikely one if you think about it, but we're now used to it. To do that in real time on a radio show, obviously you can't speckle that, you can't have in the middle of a long conversation about the Middle East all of a sudden somebody have a one-liner. That would be totally insane.
Exactly. So how do you...
And you wouldn't want to hear a comedy routine and somebody interrupt himself or herself and suddenly break into an aria about the Middle East. But you can, you know, make the show varied. You know, it's like a meal. You don't want a meal where everything is colored orange or brown, or and everything being all sweet or all hot, it grates. It wouldn't. It's not interesting.
How about some of your more staid writers going over to radio? I've known some great newspaper writers who just hate to come on the radio and quote multitask.
You know, that's their business. If they don't want to do it, nobody's got a machine gun to their head. And
these writers had a machine gun.
Well, I want people who want to do it. And, you know, I had the same experience when the web came along. When we added a website in the beginning, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that not everybody knew what to make of it in New Yorker terms. But after a while, a lot of writers became much more eager about writing for the web as well as for the page because it was something that you could do in a day or two. You got an immediate reaction from an audience, and that's a great element of variety when you're working on something for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever. It's a different rhythm. It varies your creative life. With the radio and podcasting, you have a different avenue, and you're going to be reaching different people who then may come and read you, which is...
That's what I was wondering. Have you seen a spike in subscriptions since you're doing the radio hour?
It's early for that.
Too early. Okay.
It's early for that. I mean, we're on in New York and some other markets for a few months, and thank God, you know, places like yours are joining us now, which is absolutely wonderful.
What are some of the other markets, the major markets?
Well, we're on 107 stations now. So we're doing kind of great. And of the top 10 markets in the country, I believe we're on 7 or 8 of them. So that's in a very short period of time. And as you know better than I do, people who run stations like this are a little conservative. The shifting schedules is not something they do in the blink of an eye.
Well, you have to take something off to put something new on.
Well, in our case in New York, what we replaced was a beloved show, the car show.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yes.
But in that case, one half of the team had died, and they were running reruns for a period of time. And so, obviously, nobody blamed us for that. But shifts in schedule on public radio are not something that happen every 2 seconds. So to get on 107 stations within a few months is really fabulous. And I would guess I have to owe that to the reputation of the magazine itself.
Exactly. It's the cachet of the New Yorker.
Well, I hope so. And when it comes to that, resting on our laurels is not something I want to do. I don't want to be a museum curator of a reputation of a magazine from the 50s. I want the magazine to be alive and tough-minded and funny and original and innovative now. I feel the same way about the radio.
We're speaking with award-winning journalist and author and now radio host David Remnick. He's been at The New Yorker since 1998 as editor, staff writer since 1992. For those of you who've yet to listen, Saturdays at 2, it's not the magazine read aloud. Tell us how you like it if you are listening to the program and how it differs from the magazine if you're a devotee of the magazine or how it stands alone for you. 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with David Remnick in just a second. Stay with us.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with The New Yorker editor, David Remnick. We're talking about the New Yorker Radio Hour here on Public Radio with David Remnick.
So, David, I couldn't help but I was listening, to some of the, I've heard some of the episodes, and I couldn't help but notice that there was a little Ira Glass touch in your hosting. Have you noticed that?
Have others?
Have others?
You're the first to mention it, but I should be so lucky.
Okay.
I mean, Ira Glass is This American Life is pretty fantastic, and to say nothing of popular, and it helps spawn Serial. So if after 3 months we're mentioned in the same breath, and how can I argue with that?
Well, I thought it was a good thing. I was listening to the Jane Mayer thing on the Koch brothers, and that's where I heard it. But
that show is one of the great innovative moments in contemporary radio, and Ira Glass is something else. He really is.
Coming up this Saturday at 2 here on WLRN, the New Yorker Radio Hour. David, you have a conversation with poet Clive James. How was that?
Well, that's going to be on the air this coming weekend.
Saturday here.
That's right. And Clive James is a figure we don't have the equivalent here. He was a huge figure on television, a terrific poet, a memoirist, Australian-born, and now he is, without a question, dying. And he's had a very severe form of leukemia for a while. And he is writing about that with extraordinary clarity and grace. And I spoke to him, and he was in his home in Cambridge in England. And it was, to my mind, a very moving interview, not because of anything I did, but because he's so brutally honest. And yet, I've never interviewed anybody more good-humored, funnier. Mm. in the face of the inevitable.
And changing veins, Patricia Marks, veteran writer, another
There's
veteran
the humor.
Writer, with
yeah.
the humor about trying out a large number of sleep aids.
Like well, here's a case where there is a relationship, a direct relationship between the magazine and the piece on the radio. Patty Marks is a kind of reporting humorist. She's a hilarious writer, but most of what she does is she goes and reports weird corners of the world. And what she did, she's an insomniac. She doesn't sleep very well. And she went out into the world and ordered or tried out every sleep panacea on the market. And nothing, of course, worked. And she did a radio piece about this. And it's very different from the piece in the magazine, but no less funny.
David, you've been at The New Yorker now. How many years is it?
You said 92.
497.
No. Well, he
but
started...
I'm beautifully preserved.
Well, you certainly sound very good. But I'm just wondering...
That's nice of you to say. Did you expect me to be mumbling in my soup?
No. But talk about
some
of...
I think they'd slowly usher me to the door.
No.
I think you've had enough now, Mr. Remnick.
No. You never know where you're going to go from here. Now you're a radio host. You could have aspirations to be on the silver screen after this. But
yes, that's going to happen tomorrow. I'm George Clooney, watch out.
But I was wondering what are some of the changes you have initiated at the restaurant? Oh, my God.
We're serving crab cakes for lunch.
At the magazine in your years as editor, and the things you're the proudest of.
Oh, the things we're proudest of have real range. Whether it's an investigative story like Abu Ghraib or Jane Mayer's extraordinary investigative reporting on money and politics or, you know, war correspondence. But also, you know, this is a magazine that's also helped bring to the fore some of the most extraordinary names in fiction, Zadie Smith and Juno Diaz, people like that. So there is... And believe me, it's not all on me, not even remotely, a lot to be proud of. I work with an amazing team of really tireless editors, what's changed the most, obviously, is technology has led us to be not just a weekly magazine in print, which was plenty complicated enough in the
right.
first place, but now it's a website that has 12, 15 new things published every day that have to be worthy of the New Yorker logo. And as you say, a radio show, television, and presumably we're going to start a cleaning service and restaurants around the nation.
Yes. No.
It's a good suggestion, by the way.
I don't know where that came from. I don't know.
We're going to reopen Wolfie's.
Oh, do you remember Wolfie's?
Well, you know, since you've mentioned that I'm 327 years old, my grandfather lived in Miami Beach, and I think it's the only place he would eat out.
Cheesecake.
No. It was, I think it was the corned beef sandwich with his poison.
And the waitresses with the corsages.
And at the age of 106, it finally killed him.
Is that true?
105, something like that.
And he ate those 6-inch corned beef sandwiches? My.
You know, when I would come down to see him in Miami Beach, and he lived in a big hotel in a little... place he had. You see, really modest means. It was before the real boom of Miami Beach. He lives in the Casablanca, which is in the 60s, 61st.
Oh, that's still there. It's one of the few that's there. It's 60.
I'm sure it's much more beautiful than it was in those days. It was perfectly fine. And I opened his refrigerator, and there was a can of pipe tobacco, a half a bottle of rye, and some chopped liver. And I said, we have to go out to eat. And he said, Wolfie's is the only place for me. He wasn't interested in Cuban food. That's what I was trying to steer him toward.
We have an emailer. Richard says, loved the interview in front of the live audience with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of Hamilton, and interview with Sarah Koenig, creator and host of the podcast Serial. Love tone and feel. Also subscribe to New Yorker Fiction Podcast and love it. Looks like you have several podcasts. Keep up the good work. Love getting the New Yorker flavor down here in South Florida.
How nice. I think the podcast he's referring to, the show that we're doing, the New Yorker Radio Hour, is on terrestrial radio and podcasts as well. You just go on our website. But there's also a podcast called The Political Scene. There's a poetry podcast, and there's a fiction podcast as well. So that's what that your loyal listener was referring to.
Are you a native New Yorker?
I'm the fiercest kind of parochial New Yorker is somebody who was born elsewhere, and none are fiercer than those of us who were born across the river in the state of New Jersey.
Ah.
That's where I'm from. I can see my home state from my window.
Yes.
Which is about as, that's where I want to keep it for the moment.
What is this thing I read about the Sitzfleisch or Sitzfleisch?
Sitzfleisch.
Yes, the ability to
Yiddish.
Sit through or tolerate something
it's a
boring.
Word.
Yeah, where does that come from with the New Yorker Radio Hour?
It has nothing to do with the New Yorker Radio. I think somebody once asked me how I was able to get a lot of things done, particularly writing in a short period of time, and I used the word Sitzfleisch, which means basically keeping your ass in the chair without going to the refrigerator or going online or all the million other ways we can waste time.
David, we have an idea from a listener. They want to know if you would have a New Yorker magazine cover about the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I think we don't put ads on the cover.
Just a little thing on the bottom, maybe.
I think the way to do that is to go on to newyorker.com, and you will find plenty about the radio show, and you can listen to the radio show on your computer too.
Also, in the episode coming up this Saturday at 2, Jack Ziegler talk about veteran New Yorker staff writers, talks about creating cartoons on a weekly basis. That should be really interesting because that's difficult.
We had him on before when the book came out.
Jack's an amazing cartoonist and has been around for decades. And so what happens here is every Wednesday or Thursday I have a meeting with a cartoon editor named Bob Mankoff. And he comes in with a stack of, 75, 80, what's called roughs. And they're rough drafts of cartoons that are either faxed in or sent by PDF or Pony Express, whoever they come in. And these guys, they work like hell. And to come up with original jokes and drawings, and, a lot of them send in 10, 15 roughs, and if they're lucky, one gets picked that week. It's a tough way to make a living. It's a tough way to be constantly judged by some, clown like me in Manhattan, and because there isn't anywhere else to go with cartoons. There used to be, way back when, in the days long before I was born, in Saturday Evening Post and those kind of magazines, which are long defunct, there was cartoons, and there was a real market for them. If you got one turned down, you'd go to the next place, or
right.
You could even go to Playboy and do the same catching your wife or husband in bed with somebody else joke. But really, cartooning, for the most part, I don't mean editorial cartoons, but the kind that we do, it's, we accidentally cornered the market on it. I wish it were otherwise. I wish there were more places that had them.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure speaking with you, David Rebnick. He's the editor of The New Yorker magazine. Again, for those listeners who haven't heard it, we do air that Saturday at 2 p.m., The New Yorker Radio Hour here on WLRN, and you'll get a taste of The New Yorker Radio Hour. And David Rebnick is the host.
And I also want to say he is an author, and his book Lenin's Tomb received the Pulitzer Prize and the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism.
My mother will be very happy that you mentioned that, and I am too. And thank you guys for talking with me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the show.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman, with Joseph Cooper. And today, chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer is one of the world's top chefs with us in the studio. He's Chef Eric Ripert, who has a much-talked and written-about new book out. We'll learn more about it. And, of course, wine columnist Fred Tasker is with us, as well as this week's Dinner in Minutes.
Yes, it is. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi, Linda.
Hello, Joe. Great to be here. So I want to ask you a question. I always wonder, what does it take to become a three-star chef, a Michelin three-star chef? And how do you keep up that quality year after year? Well, Eric Ripert, as you said, is our guest today. We're delighted to have him here in the studio. He's the chef and he's the co-owner of the 3-star restaurant in New York City, Le Bernardin. And in addition, you may have seen him on the Cooking Channel. He has a show called Avec Eric. It's an Emmy award-winning show. And he's nodding his head with a smile. Well, welcome, Eric Ripert.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you.
We're delighted. Thank you. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions or suggestions, or you just want to say hello to Chef Eric Ripert, give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Our email is radio@WLRN.org.
And, of course, we want to say hello to our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns that you can read in the Miami Herald. And you can read his wine column on Saturdays in the Miami Herald food section. So, Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'm going to talk about summer wines. I mean by that cool summer wines.
All right. Sounds good to me. Well, Eric Ripert, congratulations on so many accolades that you've had.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Your latest book is 32 Yolks. That's yolks like an egg yolks. And it's called 32 Yolks from My Mother's Table to Work in the Line. It's a very touching, it's a very raw and moving story. Actually, I couldn't put it down. So first tell us, what's 32 Yolks? What's the significance?
32 Yolks is a challenge that I have in a professional kitchen. I graduated from culinary school. And I end up in a 3-star Michelin in Paris, La Tour d'Argent.
This is amazing. 17 years old, you graduate from school and right into La Tour d'Argent.
Yes.
Famous Paris restaurant.
In 1982, they were celebrating 400 years anniversary.
Wow.
And on my first day, the chef asked me to cut some shallots. I cut my finger. Then he asked me to go get some chervil. I don't know what it is.
That's an herb, by the way, if you don't know.
Then he says, can you make an Hollandaise sauce? And I say, yes, of course. I did it in school. He said, okay, 32 yolks. But when you make Hollandaise, you have to separate the yolks and then you have to whisk them for 30 minutes on top of the stove and make a sabayon, which is like the consistency of almost like a cloud, right?
Right.
I was so skinny at the time and I didn't have the strength to whisk properly the 32 yolks, which, by the way, the mass of 32 yolks is 1 pound and a quarter.
Wow, and you had a big pot.
Yes, and the stove was made of cast iron. It was red. It was so hot, it was red. I thought it was a joke, but it wasn't. And instead of making that beautiful sabayon, I made pitiful scrambled eggs. And it took me...
You curdled all the eggs.
It took me weeks to master the Hollandaise sauce and the 32 yolks. And that moment, the 32 yolks defined... The naive side of a young kid who thinks he's a chef, and when you master the 32 yolks, you're part of the team. You're one of the chefs.
Okay, so
that's a great story.
It's a wonderful story, and I have to tell you, you're man after my own heart because everybody here knows I love desserts, but your first foray into loving, really loving food was chocolate mousse.
Yes, chocolate mousse, apple tarts, baba au rhum. I don't know how much rhum. Helps a 9-year-old kid, but
I'm sure it wasn't bad. But I loved your description of your first taste of chocolate mousse. It was wonderful.
Yes.
So in the book, you had a difficult childhood, a divorced parents, a stepfather gave you a lot of problems, boarding school gave you even more problems. So what gave you the strength? How did you overcome this kind of childhood?
Well, my parents divorced when I was 5. My stepfather was very abusive, physically and verbally, and I was fighting back. It was instinct, and we had a very, very tough time at home. Then it was so difficult that finally my mother decided to send me to a boarding school, and I had a big incident there. One of the priests tried to abuse me, so therefore... Of course, it was a crisis, and my mom made a scandal. However, they left me in a school until the end of the year, and I was very disappointed by that.
Even though you'd had that problem?
Yeah,
you had to see this priest every day?
Yeah, I would see him every day, but he was not allowed to come close to me. However, uh-huh. It was a big frustration. So I was kind of an angry kid. I was not happy in my life, that's for sure. And I was a fighter to survive the crisis. I mean, divorce in many occasions are a good thing for couples and sometimes for children. In my case, the divorce of my parents was a disaster, basically.
For you.
For me and for the family.
Right. And, well, you talk about in the book about your mother and how she developed her own career, became very successful running a shop, with a clothing shop. But she came home every night, made a huge dinner, and set the table with flowers.
Not only that, she would wake up at 4:30, 5 a.m. to prepare the breakfast, which was amazing, of course. But then she would prepare the meal for lunch and dinner with appetizer, main course, cheese, dessert.
Amazing.
Different tablecloth. Different china pattern in between lunch and dinner, different flowers on the table to match the pattern of the china, and for them, for the adults, not me, but they had, of course, some good wine, and we had candles at night, and it was her pleasure to do that, to create this experience, and I thought every kid in the world was eating like me.
Is your mom still with you?
She's still alive, yeah. She lives in Spain.
Well, what does she think of the book?
On the beginning, she was a little bit frustrated by some of the stories. She would have preferred for me not to share. And then last week, she sent me a couple of pictures on my phone where she's sending me kisses. So I guess
she got over it.
I thought I could get away because she doesn't speak that much English, but she understood everything.
All right.
Well, so here you are, a young boy, eating this wonderful food every single night, and then going to boarding school. What kind of food did you have there?
So boarding school was a rude awakening because the food was absolutely disgusting, not cooked with love, that's for sure. And I have some vivid memories of overcooked rice with this flavor of raw garlic in it. And I don't know why they were putting raw garlic in the rice. It's absolutely unedible.
I want everyone to know, because this isn't television, but while he's talking about this memory, his eyes are closed and he's actually remembering it right now. So, and he's shaking his head. Yes. Well, let's go to three-star restaurant. What does it take to have a three-star restaurant? I mentioned to you earlier before the show that I had a cooking teacher in Brittany. She had a two-star restaurant in Brittany, and she said that the third star was really ambiance, but you said no.
No, the star system on the Michelin Guide, which is an institution in Europe and in the world, some parts of the world, and in some cities in America, the stars are paying homage to the food, to the chef. Mm-hmm. So one star means very good food. Two stars, you should go to that place, make a detour or travel to that place. Three stars, it's absolutely exceptional. It's a must to go.
And it's all based on the food and service as well?
So the service is rated in a Michelin with forks. You have one fork, two forks, up to actually five forks, I think. That's the service. Then hopefully the restaurant is good, but you can have a three-star restaurant with a very small, humble location. In Brooklyn, for instance, Brooklyn Fair has three-star in a Michelin, four-star in the New York Times, and you basically eat in a kitchen.
I just want to interrupt for one second to say that Linda's describing everything that Eric is doing, and you don't have to anymore because Paul has us streaming live now. You can see us as well at Topical Currents on Periscope, okay, and on Facebook. So if you go to Topical Currents Facebook or Twitter, you can actually see his expressions.
That's and very high tech.
Yes. Well, that's
okay,
Paul.
This is where you are. Thank you, Paul Leary. So you had the three stars, but you've retained your three stars. And you also have 5 years, I think, consecutively four stars, which is the top rating from the New York Times.
Yeah, Le Bernardin, since 1986, has four stars in the New York Times, consistently. Yeah.
Which is wonderful. It's fantastic.
For sure, we celebrate the stars when we get them, absolutely.
Oh, and In your book, you say you have 50 chefs in the kitchen. Do you step over each other? What happens?
No, we have a big kitchen, and we need to operate. We need to have 50 cooks. Sometimes we go up to 60 in a team. Some of them work on the morning, some of them at night, and we have to give some days off and so on. But we need to have consistency, staff that has been well-trained, and we need staff in quantity, because especially Le Bernardin is specialized in fish, and you have to cook seafood at the last minute. You can't prepare in advance. Everything has to be done very quickly, and you need a lot of hands to be able to create something close to perfection.
So, I mean, now you learned about fish by working for another well-known chef. Tell us about that.
I had many mentors, but my bigger mentor was Joël Robuchon in Paris, and I worked for him in 1984-85. Then I did my military duties that was mandatory in France at the time, and then I went back with him again for two more years.
So you worked for Joël Robuchon?
Yes.
Who was a taskmaster, as you say in the book.
Yeah. Yes.
to be polite.
Yes.
And then you had to do your so at that time, every man had to do a service, military service?
Yes. In France, because the school system is free, the hospitals are free, I mean, a lot of things are giving to you. As a man, you must give back to the state, and you give 1 year of your life to defend the country potentially. It was so amateurish that they changed the laws, and today the French army is only professionals, not amateurs like me, because I was really lousy, to tell you the truth.
Where did you serve? How did you serve? In what capacity for that year?
Well, I had some training, and I was specialized in explosives, mining and demining.
No KP, though.
No. Yeah. It was kind of fun, but, you know, we were, like, not understanding really what we were doing. And then I ended up being the waiter of the general. They put me in the kitchen and to cook for the officers of the regiment, and the food was so disgusting, I went to see the general, and I said, you know, I don't mind to give 1 year of my life to be a military, but if you make me cook bad food, I'm going to be depressed. You're going to have to send me back home. And he was laughing, and he said, I'm going to send you in the commandos. But then he asked me if I wanted to be his waiter, and I said, yes, that would be good.
Wonderful. Wow. On that note, we're going to take a small break here. We're talking with Le Bernardin chef, Eric Ripert. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Eric Ripert. He's the chef and co-owner of the 3-star restaurant in New York City, Le Bernardin. His avec Eric on the Cooking Channel is an Emmy award-winning show, and his latest book is 32 Yolks, From My Mother's Table to the Working Line. It's a very moving memoir, and it talks about how he overcame a very difficult childhood to become one of the world's top chefs. And I have to say, I couldn't put the book down. It was a wonderful read. By the way, if you want to meet him, he's going to be at Books and Books at the Arts Center tonight, Thursday night. There's going to be an intimate conversation, and that's a $40 fee. That includes the signed book, and Lee Schrager is going to be interviewing him. And then there's also a 5-course dinner prepared by some of Miami's top chefs. And for more information, go to booksandbooks.com.
Now, do you get off the hook? You don't have to cook tonight?
No, tonight is vacation.
He's just going to eat and make all those other chefs really nervous.
Yeah.
Okay, but right now, if you're going to be at home for dinner, it's dinner in minutes time. And here's a very cool, fresh berry and steak salad, and it's for our very warm summer evenings. It's a one-dish meal, and it can be ready in less than 15 minutes. And I don't know if the chef will approve of this, but it's really tasty. The secret to the dish is a very simple dressing, and it's made by mixing some mayonnaise, some horseradish, and a little mustard together. So it's a very sort of tangy dressing, a little bit of warm water to smooth it out. And I used a corkscrew pasta, but any kind of shortcut pasta will be fine. So I toss the pasta with the dressing, And then I sauteed some skirt steak, but you could use any other kind of quick cooking steak, and add that to the sauce, tossed it all together. But to finish, I line a dinner plates with some salad greens. I spoon the steak and pasta sauce on top, the pasta salad on top. And now it's berry season, and I love this season because the stores are filled with strawberries and blueberries and raspberries. And so you put those, a mixture of the berries, on top of the salad. Well, if you want that complete recipe and a photo, it's on my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So, Fred Tasker, what are we drinking tonight or today or whenever?
Well, Memorial Day has passed now, and we're plunging headlong into the steamy heart of summer. It's in the 80s here, even in northern Michigan, so it's getting hot.
Oh, for you, that's really hot, Fred Tasker.
That is really hot. And as the heat rises, we will want something cool to drink. And, of course, just as fashionistas wear white in the summer, wine fans like to drink white wines. But I mean light whites, not those too rich, too oaky, too sweet, alcoholic monster Chardonnays. Now, light-bodied summer wines are often served at around 40, 50 degrees, and I say that, and then I cheat a little on that. If I'm on a picnic, I might just jam a bottle into the ice in my cooler, open it up, and start drinking it too cold, and then it's really fun to enjoy how the fruity flavors develop as the wine warms in the sun. So here are some examples of light and lively summer wines that you can try. One is, it's not heard of too much in the States, it's called Muscadet, M-U-S-C-A-D-E-T. And this is the wine that foodies in France's Loire Valley drink with seafood, especially shellfish. Wonderful combination. It's feather light and bone dry, and it tastes, to me anyway, of green pears. And the Chateau called Le Charmel makes a nice one for only about $11.
So let me interrupt you for a minute. Do you serve these kinds of wines at Bernardin, Chef?
We have an extensive wine list, and we have a lot of white wines because we are seafood, but we have some red wines and we have some rosé. Actually, rosé are good also for the summer and for the hot weather. We have that in Provence mostly, and they are very delicious.
Yes. Sorry, go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, and the next one is Pinot Grigio from northern Italy. This is light and dry and crisp with flavors of lemons and kind of green peaches, if you think of that. And Ecco Domani makes one for about $15. And next you have Albarino. We're going around the world here. This is from northern Spain, and it's lively and crisp with flavors of white peaches and minerals. And Martin Kodax makes one for about $14. Now, in Spain, they like to drink this with octopus, so you have to see if you have an octopus in your fridge.
Everybody does.
Just happen to have one, right?
Do you serve octopus?
Sure, I always have one. Anyway, Riesling, in its lightly sweet form, is also great with spicy Asian dishes, from green curry chicken to soba noodles with spicy peanut sauce. And Washington State's Chateau St. Michel makes one called Dr. Lucent Heroica. It's lightly sweet and mineral, and it's $17. And then you can actually drink Chardonnay. It turns out that you can have a lean, mean one that's not the big, heavy, too alcoholic thing. You just ask for a naked Chardonnay. Now, this is not the naughty fern type of naked. This is just the winemaker's coy description of a Chard that's not, quote, clothed, unquote, in oak from oak barrel aging. Paletto Vineyards in California makes a nice one with the green apple flavors for $20. So now, these are not unusual wines. You can find these anywhere. And one of them is sure to be right for your cool sipping this summer. So have fun.
Sounds good. And guess what? There's no bubbly.
Right.
Well, I'm certainly not against a good cold bottle of bubbly.
Okay. We know that, Fred Tasker.
I don't want to get predictable, though.
Well, that's good. So, Chef Eric Repair, what kind of light summer wines do you suggest at your restaurant?
That's the job of the sommelier.
Okay.
Because
all
I
right.
am in the kitchen.
Yes.
And depending on what you eat, we will do the perfect wine pairing to elevate the food, and for the food to elevate the qualities of the wine.
And where do you source your fish? Because it's so hard. Even here, we're surrounded by water. It's hard to get really good fresh fish.
It's true. We are lucky that we are close to Maine. Portland, Maine. We order by 6 o'clock at night, and we receive the fish 12 hours later by truck. And we buy a little bit in Boston, a lot at the fish market in New York. We have some Japanese connections, so the fish come from Tsukiji, Tokyo, overnight by plane. It's amazing how fresh the fish can be. It comes in rigor mortis. And we basically using mostly East Coast fish from America, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And from Maine, mostly you're getting lobsters?
We're getting lobsters, we're getting halibut, cod, crab.
All those northern fish, okay.
We're getting striped bass. Actually, right now they are in Montauk. They're not even in Maine yet.
So that sounds really wonderful. Now, Chef, you're so busy and you work so hard and all of that. Do you cook at home?
Yes, every Sunday.
So what do you make for yourself?
So it depends of the season. And I cook for the family. I have a son who's 12 years old, and I have my wife eating with us. And depending on what I find at the market in New York or in a winter, depending on what I find at the store, I cook for the family stews, or sometimes it's something very light, like salads and some chicken and something like that. But we never eat fish at home on Sunday, because Monday to Friday, lunch and dinner, I eat fish.
One question I always like to ask top chefs is, do you have any guilty pleasures? Do you secretly eat hot dogs or Cheetos or something like that?
The guilty pleasure is something that I do not comprehend. Whatever I eat, I don't have any guilt about it. I have only pleasure. I'm lucky in a sense that I don't like junk food too much. But if I happen to eat it, I have tremendous pleasure and zero guilt.
That's a great philosophy.
Does your son want to be a chef?
My son wants to be a chef, but he just wants to eat and he doesn't want to cook. So I don't know. He's going to have to.
That's going to be hard.
Yeah, he's going to have to work at one point.
Well, I think he's very, very wise. He can sit at your table and really enjoy wonderful, wonderful food.
Yes, thank you.
Well, it's been really a wonderful, tasty week. And great talking with you, Eric Repair. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
His book is 32 Yolks from My Mother's Table to Working the Line. It really gives you wonderful insight into his life and the life of a chef. I don't think people understand what hard work it is.
And he'll be at the Arts Center tonight.
And he will be at the Arts Center tonight. Go to booksandbooks.com to find out more about it. Fred Tasker, great advice as always. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And Joe and Bonnie, great to be with
you. Thank you. Very enjoyable.
Great listening today.
Thank you very much.
Yes, it was a
pleasure to meet you.
Well, next week is going to be our very popular one-hour restaurant review program. So I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Of course, you can call in to the Restaurant Roundabout next Thursday. So that wraps up our program for today. Bon Appetit. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary, and Polly Lantis is associate producer.
Are you going to try doing those 32 yolks tonight, Joe?
I have my whisk out. Find free audio archives of each program at our website. That's WLRN.org. And also see our Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Science Friday and Ira Flatow. Monday, we return with Harvard professor Daniel Shapiro and learn how to negotiate the unnegotiable. He teaches one of the most popular Harvard undergraduate classes. Perhaps I'll try the Cuisinart.
Might be easier.
Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. For Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, and Fred Tasker, stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.